Hello, welcome to Holton Village. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Mary Boys. Session number is 98-2 and is titled, What Was It Like to Live in First Century Palestine? Let's listen in.
The lineup of our sessions, you know, day by day. So, you know, you sit down to do this in the abstraction of one's home without thinking about all the particulars, such as the fact that it might be 3:45 in the afternoon of an absolutely gorgeous day, of course, in these lovely mountains. And I was thinking, why would anybody want to find out about first century Palestine when 20th century Holton Village today is so magnificent? So if I had some gifts to give you, I would give you a gift just for coming. So I thought maybe it might make sense to give you a little of the rationale behind this topic. There are several things. For one thing, as I discovered as I was planning today's session, it's a very simple question, but it's a much more complex answer, and I hope that you will leave at least being teased into some new ways of thinking about the first century. We're not going to do all of the first century in 60 minutes. We'd be grateful to know that. But there are two reasons in particular that I think shape this session. One is, while my primary field is the intersection of religion and education, I have always had a strong interest in and commitment to biblical studies and have done a lot of work in the intersection of the two. And while I was at Boston College teaching, I always taught some undergraduate section in New Testament. And one of the discoveries of my life, which wasn't a total shock because I'd also taught high school previous to that, is that for most undergraduates, the Bible is pretty much tabula rasa. It didn't seem to matter a great deal which Christian denomination they came from. One wishes one could say that the Lutherans in my class were so fantastic compared to everybody else, but I really would have to be truthful to say that nobody stood out by and large. But the thing that I think really struck me about that is that for so many of these undergraduates, who were good kids and for the most part came from Christian families, Jesus was so vague to them. I mean, of course, he was back there in history, along with the Vietnam War and Moses and that whole melange of people who are in the past, you know, older than they, and therefore, you know. And so one of the things that I think has interested me in some of the facts, I don't have a mind that retains facts. I have a very open mind. Things go right on through without sticking. But some of the facts about the first century, it seems to me, are very important because they give us a sense of the real person, Jesus. I'm not saying the real Jesus was just the historical Jesus, as if somehow we dismiss the presence of the risen Christ in the church. But nonetheless, it seems to me that when you can get a hold of this historical figure who was a real person in a real country, in a real time, with real problems and a culture and a religious outlook, worldview, and so forth. Second thing, as those of you who came yesterday know, this is part of a longer project on ways we must teach differently about Christianity because of what we know now about Judaism. And the people in the bookstore said we're supposed to push the books that we ordered for this. So this is actually a book that I am writing and hope to finish in January, and I have a little preview of it that's in the bookstore called Jewish-Christian Dialogue. And to connect that with this, I am horrified by how often I hear preached in the pulpit, written in devotional commentaries and so forth, things about Judaism that are designed to make us Christians feel better about Jesus, but primarily by caricaturing and distorting Judaism. I'll give you a sample. 2 weeks ago, I happened to be at a Eucharist, and I'll leave the everything else unnamed about where I was and so forth. And the gospel was the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the person who was preaching, this was not my regular congregation at all, but the person who was preaching, as I've heard before, it's not bad, and which is for me, you know, I'm very critical, I must admit. I love to be critical of it. I'm a Catholic, you know. Preaching is not one of my great gifts, but at any rate, this usually gets pretty thoughtful. thoughtful homily and began somehow by saying, trying to give a little background on the parable. And one of the things he said at the beginning was that, if you recall, the question that sets up the parable of the Good Samaritan is, who is my neighbor? So he says, now, in the Jewish mentality, and that got my attention because, as I said yesterday, you can't generalize about Judaism that easily. So in the Jewish mentality, only another Jew was your neighbor. Now, and then he just proceeded on blithely. Well, of course, I wanted to stand up and say, that's not true. And if you look at the two texts that are behind, you know, this is an argument that's going on in Leviticus about a sort of a two texts that set people up in a dilemma. I won't go into that for the moment. But one of the things that happens is that these little things, these little nuggets, are dropped so often in homiletic situations. And what they do, they add up to a pretty negative view of Judaism. I mean, you know, the person who was awake and listening, that's how Jews think. Okay, only other Jews are their neighbors. Well, that's a pretty devastating thing to think about any particular people, as if we Christians are so great at considering the whole world our neighbors. You know, they've done these experiments, I'm not sure how I feel about this, on the parable of the Good Samaritan, I think it's with seminarians, I'm a little vague in my memory about this now, where they had seminarians studying texts and so forth, and then they set up a control group, and then another group, where as they were on their way from one building to the other, there was somebody in need of help. The group that had to be there to start, you know, promptly at, say, 4 p.m., left the person lying there because they had to get their Bible study. But the other group that started at 4:10, you know, they helped. You know, this is the parable of the Good Samaritan is a challenge to all of us, you know. I live in New York City, the homeless, you know, it's very hard for me to take in the fact that when I walk to the subway, there are probably 5 homeless people I may meet. And do I think of them as my neighbor in the same way as my next door neighbor who might call and say, can you take my 3-year-old for a few minutes? You know, these are difficult things. So, what I've been doing is this project trying to use my background in biblical studies in part and my commitment to a truer portrait of Judaism, which will then give us, I think, a truer portrait of Christianity and particularly of Jesus. So, today's session is a kind of a complement to both to yesterday's, in which we looked at the Pharisees, and to the one on Friday, because I'll do one tomorrow, and then Thursday's the Jubilee Day, on the Jewishness of Jesus, the Jewish Jesus. So I realized this is a little more factually oriented than I would normally do. So I'm going to stop periodically so that you can either stand up, wake up, or ask questions or comments and so forth. So let me start broadly. Now, I must admit that when I came out here, I was going to be on the road for a month, and I left some of my most precious possessions, which are maps and diagrams, and, you know, I have a great thing of the temple at home so you can see what it's like. How many of you have been to Israel? Well, that's a start, at least. You can imagine that there's really the land. It actually exists, you know. And of course, the guides will tell you anything. You know, you go to Bethlehem and you hear some of these guides, and they'll say, now the donkey was standing there, the cow was there, you know. But anyway. So let me start broadly a little bit about the Judaism and the Roman Empire in the first century. And then I'm going to go particularly to the land of Palestine, which was the Roman name for it, the Roman Empire ruled. You remember that this is the age of empires, so you had the Persian Empire, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. So I'm not going to do a lot of, I know that everybody loves memorizing dates and names, and I'm not going to do all of that kind of thing. But the Romans had ruled in Palestine proper since 63. But Judaism was actually a fairly prominent, Jews were a fairly prominent group in the Roman Empire in general. It's very difficult to get a reliable estimate of numbers about anything at this time. There seems to be a consensus that Jews were probably between 5% and 7% overall in the Roman Empire. So they lived beyond the borders of Palestine, in part because when they had been taken into exile in Babylon in the 6th century before the Common Era, that many of them never returned and then began to, so that there were Jewish communities in Rome and Jewish communities in what would be modern-day Iran and Iraq and so forth. So they were all through the Mediterranean world. Palestine, so those Jews are called diaspora Jews, that is, they were dispersed, they lived outside. There was a very well-educated and prominent Jewish community in the Egyptian city of Alexandria, which is right on the Mediterranean coast. And much Jewish learning came from there. In Palestine proper, Jews were dispersed through really throughout the whole country, but there were differences in how it was ruled. And I thought it might be kind of useful, you know, if we started to think about, you know, how's our country set up without getting needlessly technical, because these names appear in the New Testament. I know this board's a little hard to read, but those of you who chose to sit in the back, well. I'm just going through this briefly, but the ruler that we have known from our own past as Herod the Great, it's an interesting title for Herod the Great, died probably in the same year in which Jesus was born. I'm using the designation BCE and CE, which was sort of taken over in the academic world today. It means largely the same thing as before Christ and after Christ, but it uses a more neutral designation, before the Common Era and Common Era. Because you realize when you work with Jewish scholars that divide up time before Christ and after Christ is a bit problematic. But it's the same designation of time. So Herod the Great was a Jew who ruled on behalf of Rome and ruled all of Palestine. He was brilliant. I think that if I could make a comparison, it would be he was the Donald Trump of his day. He had splendid architecture. Well, no, this is where he differs from Donald Trump. He had splendid taste. The parish church that I belong to in New York City is one block from a new building, or it's actually a building that Trump refurbished. And when they were putting it up, their condos, you don't want to know what it costs for a one-bedroom. I don't know how many million. I haven't really applied yet to live there. But the sign says, the most important building in the world. Trump has no ego problems. I don't think Herod the Great did either. But he did have, he built absolutely, those of you who've been to Israel, the Antonia Fortress in Jerusalem. He built, rebuilt the city of Caesarea on the sea. Gorgeous spot, which is... later on, where all the rulers would live, they knew how to live right. He built these huge palaces at Jericho, at the fortress at Masada, and his own little palace, you know, swimming pool, the whole thing. He knew how to live in comfort. He was brilliant in many ways, though repressive, which was typical of the time. He funded his buildings, of course, by high taxation. Agricultural products were taxed. Anybody crossing the borders into the country had to pay their toll taxes and so forth. He also was not especially family-oriented. I'm trying to think of a delicate way to say this. He had, in the course of his career, 10 wives. I'm not quite sure how it lines up, how many at a time, but he had 10 wives. His wife, Mariamne, who was the second of 10, he killed. He had married her for a political alliance, and then when things looked a little threatening, he killed her and three of his sons, and also his brother-in-law. Augustus, who was the Caesar at the time, said he would rather be Herod's pig than his son. And of course, you know how pigs were regarded by Jews, so you know that things weren't... a couple weeks ago I read a biography of Herod, and this is what his biographer Peter Richardson says. He was talented, vigorous, lusty, skillful, charismatic, attractive, influential, but a disaster in his personal life. He was not what you could call an integrated person. Now, but the one thing that he did do is that he kept the country together. You know, there is something to be said about repressive rule. If you think of what happened in the USSR, once that tight rule ended, then all these ethnic conflicts and so forth have begun to surface. Now, I'm not saying repression is therefore a good thing, but so he did keep in control these various groups around the country that might have been interested in changing things. He was very domineering. When he died, however, all kinds of social unrest happened. It happened up north, it happened in the south, in Judea, and so forth. And this is a very interesting time. This was a movement which some people today talk of as being a movement of popular messiahs. These were people who were sort of social bandits, kind of the first century Robin Hoods. And because the peasants had been so highly taxed, probably in Herod's day and probably actually throughout the first century, the peasants, which would have been the most numerous, paid about 40% of their income in taxes. At the time, they paid Rome's taxes, Herod's taxes. They had to pay a half shekel tax every year to the temple. So it was an incredible burden. And so if anything went wrong, like if there was a famine or a drought or anything like that, they had to borrow. And once they borrowed, they were forever in debt. And then you could become landless. And once you became landless, then you were reduced to the situation, say, of a day laborer. You know, it was in the parable in Matthew 20. You know, the laborers would go out at different times of the day to try to get hired. So in 4, after Herod died, there was a break with this rule. Then there were these popular messianic movements, people proclaiming themselves the Messiah that would liberate people from the oppressor, who was not only Rome, but the oppressor was also this alliance of the Jewish king and Rome. That's an important piece to remember for the next session when we talk about what does it mean that we call Jesus as Messiah. That Messiah, had many meanings in first century Judaism, and one of them had to do with these sort of popular movements. Now, when Herod died, none of his sons quite had his gifts of repression, although one came pretty close, and they divided the country into three. And I did think it should be illegal to publish Bibles without maps. But maybe we can start one way. This is the Palestine in the time of Jesus. For those of you for whom the visual is important, you don't have to focus unduly on this. And I'm going to focus particularly on two areas. If you think it's divided into three among three apparent surviving sons. The one who got the most important area, Judea, because Jerusalem's in Judea and the temple's in Judea, and the temple was enormously important in first century Judaism. It wasn't simply the center of worship life, it was the center of Jewish life in many respects, and of course it was crucial for the economy. I mean, we should all hope, we should all hope the Vatican lasts, not just for religious reasons, but because what would happen to the economy of Rome? I'm being somewhat tongue-in-cheek here, but religious institutions, you think the population of Jerusalem, say at Passover time on the pilgrimage feast, probably at least quadrupled. So you can imagine if you're a merchant, it's sort of like the NCAA coming to your town or the Super Bowl in your town. I hope I'm not being irreverent. I don't mean it in that sense. But, religion and economics are not separate spheres. But the son who got Judea, Archelaus, was so terrible. He was such a despot that Rome removed him in 6. So it only lasted 2 years. And from that time on, Rome had sent their own men. So no more Jewish rulers in the south, in Judea, where Jerusalem is. Now we have Rome ruling directly through their prefects. And there's one prefect that's especially infamous. In fact, he's so infamous we recite his name in the creed, and that is Pontius Pilate. Okay? And he was the prefect from 26 to 36. And when you go to Caesarea today, you can still see they uncovered a stone that talks about Pontius Pilate, the prefectus, 26 to 36. He was, by the way, a very venal, mean, difficult human being. The Gospels give a little different take on it, but for another reason. Now, I'm not going to say much about this region, Iturea, which was ruled by the son Philip, because not a whole lot of the New Testament takes place in that particular geographic region. But I wanted to say a word about Antipas, whom John the Baptist makes famous, and through whom, of course, John the Baptist met his end. And remember, Jesus refers to Antipas as that fox. And he was very much like his father. He had what you might call an edifice complex. He liked to build. So he built this big city called Sepphoris, which was very much in the Greek mode, and is about 3 miles from a little tiny village called Nazareth. I'll come back to that in a second. He also built, a few years later, a big city right on the Sea of Galilee called Tiberias, and he knew where his bread was buttered, because who was the ruler at the time? Tiberius Caesar. You know, if you want to make a name with the people in Rome, then you name things for them. Now, Galilee is a very rich region, a very rich farm country. A lot of it that's around the Sea of Galilee is just, it's really magnificent. And when you go to Israel, one of the things about Galilee, it's relatively unspoiled for tourists. There aren't people hawking things, you know. It's something to go to Israel, particularly for people who have these kind of romantic notions, and you walk the Via Dolorosa and you imagine Jesus on the way to the crucifixion, and you stop, and there's the Fifth Station t-shirt shop. I'm actually not teasing. They might have switched it to the Third Station by now. And there's meat markets, and these big carcasses of beef are hanging down. And of course, it's the Middle East, so flies are on it, you know. And I remember the first time I went, I thought, oh, this is just not how I imagine it in my piety. And then I said, yeah, and I bet when Jesus, wherever he carried his cross, it probably isn't the route of the Via Dolorosa today, according to archaeologists, but wherever he carried it, you know, there weren't people, there weren't pilgrims around, you know, with candles praying. It was, he went right through the crowded markets of the city, or, you know, whatever was there. But Galilee is relatively unspoiled and quite beautiful. It has sort of low-lying hills, not mountains like this. Probably in the first century, all of Galilee was less than 150,000 people, and it had these two major cities with maybe 15,000 apiece, and then smaller towns such as Capernaum with maybe 10,000, again, estimating. And then the most recent thing I've read about Nazareth from archaeologists, they think in the first century it would have been about 60 acres and about 480 people. I don't know how they get 480 and not, you know. I'm not an archaeologist. Now, I was thinking this morning, I understand that there's about 420 people in Holden right now. Someone told me that this morning. So I was sitting out in the porch today and I was thinking, you know, we're not a whole lot bigger than Nazareth, this little town. Jesus was not from a very important town. But it was only about 3 miles or so from this more important town of Sepphoris. And isn't it interesting that this town never makes the New Testament? The gospel writers just weren't interested in telling us about that. Now let me stop here for a moment. And if you want to, you know, just to sort of take this in, or ask any questions, or just any comments, something that strikes you, that maybe something that's surprising or puzzling.
What do you think the reason is they don't mention the Sepphoris?
Well, apparently Jesus had relatively little dealing with that. Although here's some speculation. Jesus, the New Testament calls Jesus a technon. And it's variously translated as woodworker, sometimes as a mason. You know, we usually think of Jesus as a carpenter, but people who have more knowledge about first century life suggest that carpenter might be too narrow, that, you know, it might have even been a bricklayer. He probably made furniture and so on and so forth. Now, there's some speculation that if Joseph and Jesus were engaged in this artistry, that they might have been employed at various occasions at Sepphoris. But you know, the New Testament isn't very interested in giving us much biographical detail. So, you know, but it does at least, you know, you think he lives in a small town, but there's a big city nearby. The other thing that's interesting, of course, in the New Testament, very little takes place in Nazareth. Because, you know, the hometown people, hometown people are a bit scandalized, you know, by, you know, who is this, you know? Is not this the carpenter's son, you know, the woodworker's son? And so he actually spends much more of his time on these cities that ring the Sea of Galilee, including the you know, Capernaum is the one that we know of, you know, we think of most often that. And there's some very interesting digs that have been happening at Capernaum. You know, nothing that makes you read the New Testament with startling new eyes, but any other comments or, yes?
I read an archaeologist one time who made something of the difference between Jesus' teaching in Galilee is over against once he sets his face to Judea,
yeah.
Trying to make some political comparisons there that life in Galilee was more placid than in Jerusalem and Judea. Would you concur with that?
Well, I suppose if you could, you know, if you think that in general in rural areas life is more placid than in big cities. I was laughing to myself because I live in New York and I was thinking, how can I sleep? There's no car alarms, there's no fire alarms. And then thank you very much this morning, we had a fire alarm. I think the difference is this. Judea, remember, has Jerusalem, has the temple. And I want to talk on Friday a little bit about what Jesus' relationship might have been to the temple. Somebody pointed out to me one time that, and again, you have to be careful with an argument from silence, but that it never mentions in the New Testament that Jesus, or in the Gospels in particular, that Jesus stayed overnight in Jerusalem. He stops by his friends Mary and Martha and Lazarus, who live in Bethany, which is just over the hill, east of Jerusalem. And Jesus certainly has a tense relationship with both the religious and the secular establishments in Jerusalem. I think Jesus, I think it would be a startling thing if Jesus didn't go to the temple and offer sacrifice. I think the reason it's not mentioned is that it would just be taken as a commonplace. But he doesn't spend a lot of time around the temple. He's not at all associated with the priesthood. In fact, he seems to be, you know, to really hold back from there. So I suspect that Jesus found the establishment of Jerusalem a bit off-putting. And I don't think he was welcome, and I mentioned those messianic movements around 4. Now remember, if you're the Roman rulers, and they have a long memory about insurrections, and now you have, and one of the biggest insurrections was up in Galilee, and these were messianic, I mean these people talked to them as the Mashiach. So when Jesus comes to town, he's got a reputation that probably is related to the fact that he's from Galilee, where there have been insurrections, although it's under, of course, different rule, and he has some people who are apparently calling him Messiah. Now, again, that's hard to reconstruct because the passage about, you know, Jesus and Simon Peter and, you know, you are the Messiah, but then, you know, Peter's got the right answer but all the wrong reasons. You know, good old Peter, he always, always gets it almost right, but not quite. So I think Jesus seemed to be freer up north. But you know, I guess it may be, I think sometimes religious establishments can kill all religion. and so maybe, okay, anything else?
Well, he did have some relationship to the temple because at the age of 12, he sat there for 3 days and listened to them.
Or they to him. I mean, yeah, I think there's no question that he would have visited the temple, and particularly as an adult offered sacrifice, as was required in Torah. I mean, I think of Jesus as a Torah observant Jew. Now, however, the people from the Galilee, because remember, this is not the time when you have, they had fairly good roads, because the Romans built good roads, but still, transportation left a great deal to be desired in terms of rapidity. So getting to Jerusalem wasn't so simple. So the people from Galilee wouldn't have gone to the temple all that often because it was just too far. So the temple was less important to the Galileans than it was to the people in Judea. Now let me say a word about these various groups. Yesterday, some of you who were here, we talked about the Pharisees as being a group, sort of a voluntary association a fairly serious Lutheran, Jewish lay people who came to, who really took their faith seriously, who were not any more hypocritical than any other group of people who try to take a faith seriously, and who emphasized certain practices of Judaism, three central practices of Judaism I put up here. I would say that the Pharisees particularly emphasized keeping of the Sabbath and these purity laws, that is, ways of eating and ways of acting that distinguished Jews from Gentiles. I always have to be clear, I remember one time while I was teaching undergraduates, unfortunately it was a very large class, but fortunately this happened at the break, and this young man came up to me and he asked, could you clarify again the difference between a Jew and a Gentile? spelling is very helpful. And one of the other key practices of Judaism that separated Jews from many other people, although Egyptians practiced this, was the practice of circumcision. We have no idea how this practice got started, but I do remember teasing the undergraduates. Inclusive language was kind of a new thing to them. I don't know where they've been all their lives, but anyway. So with my last name being Boys, this is always a bit of a problem. But so I was trying to tease them into using inclusive language. So I got a paper about the person being circumcised, he, she. And I sort of realized, leave nothing unsaid, really. To say what circumcision is, give them the whole story. Okay. So there are, in first century Judaism, you might say that Judaism in the first century is a constellation of these beliefs, Torah, monotheism, the one God, Deuteronomy 6:4, Shema Israel, Adonai Echad, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, covenant, and the temple. Now, what you did with all these things, how you interpreted them, was interpreted in various ways. How you read Torah was vigorously debated among first century Jews, just as how we read the scriptures is vigorously debated within every Christian denomination and between Christian denominations. I have some people ring my doorbell who are quite clear that I'm not saved because I don't accept Jesus Christ in quite the same way that they do, and they're sure I'm damned. I think I'm damned, if not for that reason, but anyway. And I'll always remember my grandmother arguing with the Jehovah's Witnesses who come to the door, and she never learned that there's no point in arguing, but at any rate. So vigorous debate among religious communities is something that simply goes with the territory. Now, yesterday I talked about one group, the Pharisees, who had particular ways of reading Torah which helped them to sort of extend the regulations about the temple and so forth, to sort of take it into everyday life. It really would be, in many respects, I think of many of the ways in which the church is extended into the family here at Holden. I think that there's a real similarity there. Now, I'd like to mention a couple of other groups. We don't know all that much about the Sadducees. They seem fairly allied with the priesthood, but not all Sadducees were priests, and not all priests were Sadducees. They seem to be a little bit more, however, connected with religious and secular establishment. We know very, very little otherwise. Now, you heard of the scribes. The scribes covered a lot of territory. They were probably minimally people who were, when they say literate in the first century, the best estimates is that maybe 15% of people in the first century were literate, 10 to 15%. And that meant that they could read some simple documents and write. Maybe they could read whatever the equivalent was of the Reader's Digest. I don't know. Reader's Digest is supposedly published at the fourth grade level. That's what I've heard. I don't know that.
Everything is.
So we have the scribes. Now, the scribes were, some of them would have been much more skilled and much more educated. So they encompassed sort of people who could kind of, in your little village of Nazareth, you probably would have had to have a few scribes who could copy official documents and maybe send, I suppose if your mother died, you could have go to a scribe and he could write the message and send it on to wherever. And then you had scribes who would be employed at the temple or scribes who would be employed in the Roman court who would be much more literate. But again, we don't know very much about them beyond that. Then you have two other groups that I'd like to talk about in particular that are most interesting to me. One are the Samaritans, who were Jews, although they had a sort of a disagreement with other Jews about some very central things. They agreed with many other Jews that the temple was central. But for them, the temple was not the temple in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. They had their own temple in Samaria on Mount Gerizim. So, and they had their own center at Shechem, which of course is the place in which the covenant had been made. Then further studies have been found in which we can see that even within the Samaritans, they had variations in different groups, some quite like the Pharisees. Interestingly, there are still Samaritans. There are about 400 or so left in Israel. And every Passover, wherever they live, they all come up to Mount Gerizim and they stay there for the whole Passover feast. And they still sacrifice the lamb and so forth. And only one time was I able to go up to Mount Gerizim. It's in the so-called occupied territories now. And so it's not so easy to get up there because of the politics now. And you know, you can see the altar, stone altars, where they sacrifice the lambs and so forth. It's really like sort of seeing something from the New Testament really come alive right before your eyes. And you can go up there if I lived in Israel. Well, politics were different, but one can go up and observe. They had their own calendar. It's interesting how it is you dissent, you see, in religion. If you don't agree with what, you know, one, like the group in power, then one of the things you do is you have your own center of worship and you have your own liturgical calendar. So what happens when there's a major schism in Christianity? We have Orthodox Christmas and Christmas and Easter and so forth of Western Christianity. They have their own liturgical calendar. It's sort of the great tragedy of Christianity that even on our greatest feasts, not all Christians celebrate at the same time. Now, there was another group of Jews that also were even more alienated from the way that their group, if you want to make any analogies to various groups within your own denomination, this is the group that withdrew from Israel, from the society of first century Palestine, and they went down to the shores of the Dead Sea. Now, I have to say, if you're going to withdraw from society, the Dead Sea would not be... I could withdraw from society at Holden Village or Hawaii or something. You know, but you had to be very serious about your faith to go to Qumran. I mean, it is bloody hot there, even in May. I can't imagine what it's like on the 21st of July. And it is smelly. The Dead Sea is rightly called. And if you go in the Dead Sea, I know, you know, they always say you can't sink because it's so heavy with sodium. But of course, your skin fries, all that salt and so forth. I don't think they spent a lot of time sunbathing. But at any rate, so they built this complex across the, I was going to say across the road from the Dead Sea. I don't think there was a road quite in the same way at that time. And they probably didn't go by tourist buses. But at any rate, and they were so alienated that they were not only alienated from Gentiles, they were so critical of the way Jews were assimilating into what they regarded as Gentile culture that everybody who was not at Qumran with them was part of the sons of wickedness, the sons of darkness. They didn't use inclusive language, but I guess we can excuse them. So they were the sons of light, and they were the community in which the covenant would be renewed. And they expected a real apocalyptic breakthrough. The year 2000 was right on their, the same kind of the millennial notions of the year 2000 were very much present with them. And they expected, by the way, that when the end came, there would be two messiahs, a priestly messiah in the sort of the reign of Aaron, the kind of the tradition of Aaron, and one in the tradition of Moses. And they were so organized that they had the seating plan drawn up for the messianic banquet, who would sit where and all of this kind of thing. And we know a lot about this group because in 1947, as one of the undergraduates told me one time, a shepherd boy named Bedouin found the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, it was a Bedouin, but not sure, that was not his personal name. And there are some 812 documents that have been recovered from various caves where they hid them when the Romans, in the civil war between Rome and the Jews in 66 to 70. And they're actually, we know more about the Essenes than we know about any other Jewish group in the first century. And what they helped is, like, if you take the most extreme group in your own religious denomination, you know, I can think of a few in mine. Of course, they would put me at the extreme too, so, you know, but it's every, and you say that, okay, in the year 4000, the only thing you might know much about Catholicism is you'd know about this group called Opus Dei, and which is, to me, they're kind of to the right of Genghis Khan, okay? So, and wouldn't it be ironical that all the other literature and so forth might be lost, but what you'd have extensive documents about this one group called Opus Dei? Well, that's in a sense what we have about first century Judaism. The most extensive library we have is about probably the most extreme group. And we'll talk a little bit about Jesus on Friday. He has some real differences of opinion from the people at Qumran. But the teachings of, there are teachings in the early church that share some very broad similarities. I don't want to give these people a bad name. They were very strict. I mean, you went through a whole period of training, and I can't remember all of the details. I didn't bring my copy of the scrolls with me, so I'm not so good on memory. But for instance, if you laugh in the assembly, you know, 30 days you have to be on your own, solitary, and so forth. Well, I know that I never would have made it through the period of training, but I wouldn't have to worry because it was probably, well, it's a lot of, you know, it's mostly men. There's a lot of discussion, was it a celibate community, which would have been unknown in Judaism before or since. But then recently they uncovered some graves of women and children, but there are many fewer women and children than there were men, so they think, well, maybe men came for a certain period of time, and then they're, I mean, who knows quite what it was. So just to review then and to bring this to a conclusion, first century Judaism was very, very mixed. And so you can't talk about the Jewish mentality. I mean, the Essenes don't represent the Jewish mentality. The Pharisees don't, because, and there's no one group that's representative, and people didn't necessarily belong to one group. What you can generalize about first century Palestinian Judaism, and probably Judaism everywhere, is that these four things were very important: Torah, monotheism, covenant, and temple. But what was controverted among them was how you regarded them. The people at the Dead Sea regarded the covenant as fulfilled in their midst. You know, when Jeremiah talks about the new covenant that was written on the heart, that was the text that they saw fulfilled in their hearing. So you can see that when Christians want to talk about the new covenant being fulfilled among us, that in a sense it's a competing interpretation about where the covenant might be renewed. The temple was very important, but it was so important that there are two groups of Jews, the Samaritans who have their own temple, and the Essenes, I didn't say much about this, they were totally down on the priesthood. They said some of the nastiest things about the Jerusalem priesthood that you could ever imagine. They were incredibly alienated from what they regarded as the religious establishment. You know, they saw them as just, and there was a lot of corruption in the high priesthood because of the fact that, remember, Judea is ruled by the Roman prefect, and the high priest at this time could only be appointed with the approval of Rome. So there was corruption. So thank God there's no corruption in religious groups today. That has disappeared. You know, we have no problems. And there's no politics or economics connected with our religious faith, right? So.
I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Oh, yeah? I got one, too. Lives closer to me. So there's just a couple minutes left. Anyone, I'm sorry if I went to, you know, too many facts too fast, but I'm just trying to give you a little feel for what it was like. It wasn't so simple life in the first century, which gives me a lot of consolation. In fact, one of the things, the more I know about the early church, and I see, now you just, maybe I could just close with this and then if there's a question. Now remember in the early church, say now 10 years or so after the death of Jesus, who's there? Well, You probably have Jews of a Pharisaic persuasion. We know we have Samaritans because it's mentioned in John's Gospel several times. Remember the woman whom Jesus meets at the well becomes the evangelist to Samaria? Now let's just say, so, and there was a lot of bad feeling between Samaritans and some other Jewish groups. So here you are now, all believers in Jesus, and you're sitting next to people whom they previously hated. And then you've got a few Gentiles who are coming in, probably not as early as 10 years after, but probably in some, at least maybe some minimal numbers. And, you know, the early church, you know, we look at, you know, how they loved one another. We read these summaries in Acts and how, you know, they went to the temple praising God and they gave of their goods and so forth. But then when you read a little more closely in the text, you see that they didn't get along so well always. I find that a great consolation so that we're not scandalized by our own divisions. You know, the early church had a lot. They came from a tradition where there were many divisions, and then all those divisions came into the church. And why is it there's so much teaching in the Gospels about forgiveness? Because that's what they needed to hear. So there's time maybe for one comment or question or...
I'm encouraged by how far we've come.
Yeah, I think so too. It's not like the progress has been a steady ascent, but there's some pretty marvelous things that have happened. So.
Well, you're talking about 10 years later. Of course, Paul was a Pharisee.
Paul was was from a Pharisaic background.
And he also was from the diaspora because he was born in southern Turkey.
Right, and he was a Roman citizen, so he had certain privileges that other people. Well, I didn't. You know, there are certain class things that we might get at, and I'll talk on Friday about to what extent can we think of Jesus as poor and marginal, and some of those things. So enjoy the rest of the afternoon. Wait a minute, I have 15 more minutes, don't I?
Yeah.
Well, why don't we stand up and just take a short break? Because it really is, I have plenty more material.
You were talking about the other things written in blue. You've
yeah.
gone from temple to
right.
covenant. We'll finish those
okay.
in your groupings.
All right. My Torah, this is another thing that was controversial. Torah refers to the teaching. By the way, the word Torah, which we usually translate as law, really means in Hebrew something closer to like instruction, the Tao, a way of life. And eventually it comes to be encoded in what will become scriptural texts. But of course at this time, the final canon, the final, you know, the norming of what's in the Bible is not settled. But the texts had been gathered. Many of the texts of the Torah were collected and edited during the exile in Babylon, which makes a lot of sense. When people are in exile, they need to have these foundational texts. And the texts were proclaimed when people gathered, assembled for worship. They probably, by the time of the first century, relatively few Jews in Palestine spoke Hebrew. Instead, they spoke a dialect of Hebrew called Aramaic. And that's probably what Jesus spoke. I mean, that's what most linguists suspect. And so that the passage from the Torah would be read in the synagogue. It probably wasn't until the third century that you had buildings that were just dedicated as synagogues, you know, set aside. So whatever the building they gathered in, a synagogue, synagoge in Greek simply means a gathering place. And the reading would be done in Hebrew, which was the language of the text, and then someone, an interpreter, would do a translation on the spot, a simultaneous translation, or almost a paraphrase, in the language of the people, which was Aramaic. So Torah, then the Samaritans only considered the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Torah, as normative. But other Jews, you know, regarded, they read from the prophets as well as from the Torah. You know, this is a difficult word to define because we talk about the Torah scrolls, and that means the scrolls of the first five books of the Bible, or the Pentateuch. But then the Torah also means this larger body of literature, including the prophets and the wisdom writings. But for the Samaritans, there were only these five Genesis through Deuteronomy that were norming scriptures. So even there you have a disagreement about what's in the scriptures. Just as in the Christian denominations today, between Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestants, we have different collections or canons. Now, fortunately, I think that ceased to become a very controversial thing. And most Bibles today are printed, or many Bibles today are printed ecumenically. And something like the Bible that I use the most, which is the New Revised Standard Version, has the disputed books in a separate section in the middle of the Bible, which is a very intelligent thing because everybody, even if they're not sacred or normative for your community, it's good to know what's in them. Now, on monotheism, I don't know that there was a lot of disagreement that there is one God, but I think it took them a long time to get there. But this does seem to me the one foundation, one thing you can say with surety is that Jews believe in one God. Now, how that's understood, what the oneness of God means, again, people will have different readings. Yes?
When do you think this monotheistic emphasis kind of developed within Judaism?
Well, I'd have to really think about this more carefully than, it's an excellent question. I think it may be in a more primitive period. It's a sort of the sense that my God's better than your God. I mean, I'm thinking of 1 Kings 18 and Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Remember that? I mean, that's just a wonderful passage. And, it really, their God, whom we Christians sometimes pronounce the unpronounceable Yahweh, but, the Holy One, bests the prophets of Baal as God. And, it's quite a contest there. But it is, I think, increasingly, it became the sense that there is the one sovereign of the universe. I also suspect that much later on, when Christians come to articulate a Trinitarian belief, then monotheism becomes even proportionately more important in Judaism for their own identity. Now, I've actually never read that, but it just to me, it's sort of intuitive.
What role would, let's say, the exile or the return have played in the development of?
Well, I think the primary role that monotheism played in Judaism was to distinguish them from their neighbors who were polytheistic. So I think it was primarily an identity thing. I mean, it's a deep religious conviction, but it also played the role of separating them, that there is only one sovereign. Yes?
When you talk about monotheism, do you mean that the Jews believe there was one God, or do you say that the Jews believe that their God was better than the other gods? And I just refer to the passage in 1 Kings where you've got the gods of Baal against Yahweh.
Well,
is it my God is better than your God, or my God is no God?
Well, first of all, it's very difficult to say at any given period this is what all Jews thought of belief. It seems reasonable to me to think that a belief that became as central as monotheism didn't get there overnight. And that certain people would have understood it to be our God is better than your God. It seems to me that one of the things that might lead to logically, if our God is better than your God, then our God's the only real God. I think that would be an example.
Well, the first commandment says, thou shalt have no other gods before me, which indicates there are gods. But our God is the first God. You shall have no other gods before me.
Right. And then as that becomes, as a religious community grows into a sense of what its tradition of faith means, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. So that the oneness of God that is the most central prayer of Judaism. We know, for instance, in the first century, that the Shema was recited by Jews. They have found it was written in the... if you go to a Jewish home, or many Jewish homes will have a mezuzah on the doorpost, and inside the mezuzah is written the Shema, the Deuteronomy 6, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, and other verses from Deuteronomy. And they have found these mezuzah, which is the plural, in various caves and so forth. And so they know archaeologically that first century Jewish homes had these. So we know the Shema was a very important prayer even in the first century. So, but precisely how an ordinary Jew understood the oneness of God, well, how does, if you stood at the back of your congregation as people are filing out of church on Sunday and said, how do you understand the Trinity? You know, yeah, people would say, huh? I just came to church, you know, I'm just, you know, so it's very difficult. This is why, in a sense, when I say these are the beliefs, that one of the ways you get at a little more of the sort of the living character of Judaism is to say, okay, how did they practice them? You know, what did it really mean in actuality, in the real world? And this is a little more difficult for me to get at, except that the one practice that I can really clearly link with monotheism is this recitation of the Shema. Now, with temple, we can see that they have certain customs about when they went to temple and, you know, and so forth. I can say more about that. And I want to talk a little bit about sacrifice on Friday, because we really have prejudices against animal sacrifice. I mean, really, that just seems so gross to us. But that's part of our problem as moderns. You know. Other questions or comments? Yes?
At the time of, after the Exodus, they had a hard time keeping the Jewish people with the one God. There was many instances.
Well, right. Well, you know, how many heresies have there been around the Trinity in the history of Christianity? Sure. I mean, well, look, this is why, particularly after the exile, intermarriage became such a problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're up north, you marry a nice Canaanite woman, or you marry a Syrian, or whatever. And they had their household gods. Now, you don't want to make waves in the family, right? You got to deal with your mother-in-law and your father-in-law and so forth. So you got God of Israel, and then you've got Baal or whoever the local deity was, and you just try to keep peace in the family. So it makes sense, after the exile, when there was this, which is 587, before the Common Era, which is a tremendous crisis for Israel, tremendous faith crisis, end of the kingdom. End of the king, which, and God's steadfast love was somehow mediated through the monarchy, even though the monarchs, for the most part, were pretty hapless and very corrupt in some cases. And so when they come back, there's this real desire. They rebuild the temple. They renew themselves. They renew the covenant. They rededicate, you know, kind of purify the community. And one of the things that's quite clear is that, you know, intermarriage is banned, and that may seem to, and that's, you know, we begin to look at them and say, oh, they're narrow, they're legalistic. But if you're going to keep a community, I mean, I know today, since I work a lot with Jews, that many Jews I know are more worried about intermarriage than they are about, like, Christian missionizing. Why? Because for the most part, when Jews marry Gentiles, they do not practice Judaism. I mean, the statistics are fairly alarming. And there's a sense that particularly after 6 million Jews have been killed in the Holocaust, that now to the bitter irony of losing the vitality of Jewish practice by intermarriage is just too bitter to bear. Now, I have to say, as a Christian, I don't look on the same way as intermarriage. I mean, there's so many of us. I do care, but I mean, one less Christian does not endanger the family of Christianity. So, you know, we have to, you know, look at something like intermarriage at times of crisis as a practice that sort of leads you outside, or maybe it's not a practice, maybe I should say what happens with intermarriage, say after the exile, or maybe for contemporary Jews, is that the intensity of practice of your own faith is diminished. I mean, what do you do on holidays? I mean, a Christian, you know, if you marry a Christian woman, this is being very sexist here, I'm going to presume that the woman's doing the cooking for Passover, so bear with me for this it's pretty limited, but anyway. So I can learn to make the filet of fish, and I can learn to, that's where my dialogue kind of, you know, the filet of fish, you'd have to have had it in your mother's milk, and I didn't have it in mine, but anyway. And I can make, you know, the various things that go with the Passover meal. But that's not the same thing as the real practice of Passover and the real investment in that story. And telling this, and again, I can read the Haggadah, but it's not the same thing as it being my people. So what I'm trying to do is to give us much more of a sense of the complexity of the Jewish world from which Jesus came. and to make it impossible for us to say, well, that's what Jews thought or did or whatever. And so that when we then talk about, well, what does it mean that Jesus was Jewish? How did he stand vis-a-vis his contemporaries? And that's what I'll get into on Friday. And I don't promise you that the Jesus that will come out of that will be, you know, all of a sudden this brand new startling Jesus. But I do think it's, I have to say personally, that this quest to answer this question has helped me to have much greater feel for, you know, when I read the gospel text, I have a much greater feel for the sort of the man behind the words. So that's where we are. And now it really is time to go. This changing times, all that, it's really confusing. So thank you very much for your attention.